to the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Who is the soul?
Atmadei.
Who gives himself without hesitation. Atmatya.
Who is the Supreme Soul?
Paramatma.
Eva.
Indeed. So translation, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is situated in everyone's heart as the Super Soul, sells himself to his devotees, such as Narada Muni. In other words, the Lord gives pure love to such devotees and gives himself to those who love him purely. A great self-realized mystic yogis, such as the four Kumaras, also derive great transcendental bliss from realizing the Super Soul within themselves. So, purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada, the Lord became Bali Maharaja's doorkeeper not because of his giving everything to the Lord, but because of his exalted position as a lover of the Lord. So short purport, so we can read the next verse with its purport. Text 22. Novai Bhagavan Nunam Amushyana Jagraha Yadutta Punar Atmanu Smriti Amoshanam Maya Maya Bhogaishvaryam Ivatanuteti. The Supreme Personality of Godhead did not award his mercy to Bali Maharaj by giving him material happiness and opulence. For these make one forget loving service to the Lord. The result of material opulence is that one can no longer absorb his mind in the Supreme Personality of Godhead. For purport, there are two kinds of opulence. One which results from one's karma is material, whereas the other is spiritual. A surrendered soul who fully depends on the Supreme Personality of Godhead does not want material opulence for sense gratification. Therefore, when a pure devotee is seen to possess exalted material opulence, it is not due to his karma. Rather, it is due to his bhakti. In other words, he is in that position because the Supreme Lord wants him to execute service to him very easily and opulently. The special mercy of the Lord for the neophyte devotee is that he becomes materially poor. This is the Lord's mercy because if a neophyte devotee becomes materially opulent, he forgets the service of the Lord. However, if an advanced devotee is favored by the Lord with opulence, it is not material opulence, but a spiritual opportunity. Material opulence offered to the demigods causes forgetfulness of the Lord, but opulence was given to Bali Maharaj for continuing service to the Lord, which was free from any touch of Maya. It's interesting. So, Om Ganatim Dandasha Gananjana Shilakaya Chakshur Meditam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So, I was just hearing from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's famous exposition of Krishna's pastimes called the Love Locket. Anyway, you know, a locket means, anyway, something like you keep a picture of your beloved and the little petunia or whatever his name is, and lock it. So Krishna actually wanted to understand Radharani's love for him. And of course, referring to this particular point is that Krishna gives himself to those who love him purely. That's the previous verse. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's the greatest opulence, because we're talking about Bali Maharaj's opulence. You know, he had this planet, you know, Sutala, and later on, of course, he even had a higher position than that. But the greatest opulence is actually to be able to control the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So one would think that when you can control God, you become very proud, because that's the problem of opulence. As described by, in the Bhagavatam, described in the Bhagavatam, Janmaishvarya, by Queen Kunti actually, Janmaishvarya, Shrutasya Shribiraitamana, Adapuman. What did she say? That if you, become attached to your opulences. And of course, she lists a few of the opulences. Janma, good birth. Like, I was born in the chosen family. There's a religion. Actually, there's a religion where you're one of the chosen. And I was born in that family. I'm one of the chosen going back to Godhead. So anyway, so Janma Aishvarya, and if one has wealth, and Shrutasya, if one is very learned, or if one is very beautiful or handsome, Shribir, Janma Aishvarya, Shrutasya, Shribir, if one looks like Rambo, then one actually gets bewildered with a sense of false pride. Because you tend to think that these attributes that you have belong to you. You become proud of them. Little do you understand that they will be taken away by the time factor. That's one of the topics of the Bhagavad Gita we mentioned last night. What does the time factor do? Kalena sarvatra gavira rama. It is very deep. It just takes away everything from everyone, except for Krishna. And of course, it doesn't take away devotional service. As Krishna says in the Gita, Svapamapyasya Dharmasya Trayate Mahatovaya, a little endeavor frees one from the most dangerous fear. One, there's no loss or diminution from one lifetime to another with devotional service. So, anyway, so everything else is taken away by time, but we become very proud of these things. I mean, not only the opulences listed by Queen Kunti, there are other opulences too. Of course, there's the six primary opulences that we talk about in relationship to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's why Krishna is called Bhagavan. You know, like Krishna is the most attractive, there's beauty there. Krishna is the most intelligent. Krishna is the strongest. Krishna is the most renowned. Krishna is the most famous. All these different opulences belong to the Lord. And of course, Krishna doesn't get proud of these things because he's just immersed in loving exchanges with his devotees. Whereas we have this tendency to get very proud of these things and think, basically we think we have become God in a real sense, or we deny the existence of God. Just like last night I was talking about this one interesting topic, at least interesting for me, maybe not interesting for the rest of you, the topic of singularity. Because I've been looking into that lately. Not that, I mean, maybe it's just sense gratification for me. But in any case, it's interesting because it relates to the false pride that arises, the concept of this coming singularity in the minds of the scientists and the minds of those who are philosophers, points out the problem with thinking that you can manipulate matter and actually become all-powerful or live forever and things like that. I mean, singularity, as I mentioned last night, means that man and machine, they will merge into one, or man and electronics, or man and scientific advancement. And there's a lot of propaganda about this particular subject matter. And even they have developed machines with something called neural networks, and neural networks are similar networks like we have in the brain that can actually go from, I don't want to get too technical, but can actually switch circuits all the time from one neuron to another as you make mistakes or learn different things, which is quite different than the networks you find in an ordinary computer. So they actually have machines that learn how to walk based on this neural network thing. You know, they have... they made a little dog. It's actually funny. They made a dog. What they have to do is start. It's a real loud dog because it has a gasoline engine to power it, and it moves by hydraulics. Do you know what hydraulics are? Yeah. Hydraulics are like when you got the bulldozer or something like that. What moves the blade up and down is these hydraulic. Basically means a liquid. By pressure, moves a little piston in and out. All right. Anyway, so there were pictures of these mechanical animals learning how to walk. It was actually frightening. So they're actually In the beginning, they're like a little kid, you know, they're stumbling a lot, and then after a few minutes, they learn how to walk. Frightening, isn't it? It says, oh my God, they're taking over. So, of course, I mean, they're just imitating the function of the brain. There's nothing, let's say, fantastic about it. But this particular living, not a living entity, even I'm making that mistake. So this particular entity, whatever it is, doesn't have consciousness, although it may emulate the consciousness of a person. I mean, just like, for example, those of you who have Apple iPhones, there's this thing called Siri in it. Anyone's heard of that before? Where you talk to it, and it seems to respond. You know, I joked around with it, you know, I just said to it, you know, it's a lady, so I said, how old are you? And she basically came back, it's none of your business. Or what's it to you? You know, just like trying to evoke some humanity out of the machine. But these are just program responses. It's not that Siri actually has a consciousness behind her. Because consciousness can only come from spirit. So anyway, so there's this whole, one of the concepts of singularity is that you can get consciousness from matter. And the more advanced your computing power becomes, I mean, after some time, the computers have become more intelligent than human beings and actually more conscious than human beings. And of course, they talk about nanotechnology. I don't know if anyone has heard of nanotechnology. I mean, it's interesting. You can learn these things in class and impress people. Nanotechnology means they can move like atoms. You know, the scientists are very proud. They can take one atom and move it from one place to another. So they say if they could make a computer based on the atomic scale like that, of course, there's a lot of problems with that, such as the uncertainty principle, but we're not going to get into that. But so then that computer could be the size of a sugar cube. That would be more powerful than all the computers in the world put together. So they may make a computer like that. I'm not denying that. But it's still not going to have consciousness. So what? And then when they do that, as this Krishna described in the 16th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, the divine and demoniac nature, that people create these works, and ultimately they're utilized to create destruction in the world. I mean, just like atomic energy. Even when you try to use it for peaceful uses, it pollutes the whole atmosphere. I mean, what to speak of when you try to use it for for killing people, for hurting people. So then people now are very much afraid of this, let's say the nanotechnology. They'll create little nano warriors. They'll go into your body and destroy you. And each of these nano warriors will duplicate themselves. I mean, they'll learn how to reproduce. And they'll reproduce, and somehow they'll take over the earth, and they'll kill all of us, and, you know, we'll all be dead. But in the meantime, we'll have downloaded our consciousness. I'm sorry, uploaded our consciousness. You've got to use the right term. To the computer, so we're actually living within these creatures. Or living within the computer, or living within the neural network, the giant neural network that encompasses all of the earth, and in fact all of the universe. When we learn how to go through these black holes in space, then we can go to the whole universe and turn the whole universe into our neural network. I mean, this is actually what they're talking about. I'm not just making this up. This is not just something that, you know, I dreamt about last night. They're talking about, you know, how we're going to change the universe. It's all going to become one neural network, and we're all going to live in that neural network. It's something like in that Avatar movie where they had this big tree that was a neural network, and everybody, all the dead people were living in it. And of course, that was based on biology, not on modern science. So, I don't want to get too far into this crazy discussion, but they just become very proud, you know, that how we're going to change everything, and but basically, they're going to destroy each other using the technology, because it's just a proven fact that when they come up with new technology, the new technology is used for destructive purposes, and ultimately it's going to be used in war. Prabhupada pointed that out, you know, atomic weapons like that were already used in war. And the United States now is just so, at least the government is apparently so nervous about other countries, like renegade countries, like North Korea, developing atomic weapons. I mean, North Korea already has atomic weapons, but developing the means to deliver them, and then there's just like crazy people in charge of the government. And the funny thing is that we criticize North Korea for having a crazy leader. But, you know, in America, are we any better off? You know, are people less crazy? I mean, because everybody in this world is controlled by lust, anger, and greed. And actually, this is our problem. And so when you put power, you know, what do they say? Great power means great responsibility. Gopal was here, who would have liked that particular statement because it comes from one of the movies he likes. But if you have power in the hands of people who are demoniac, literally, or at least godless, or at least not having compassion for others, or being lusty, or being interested in increasing their power and prestige and all these other things like that, then it's definitely a very destructive force for the world. So this is the problem. So let's get back to something nicer. We were talking about the love locket. This is not the love locket I was just talking about. So who has greater power than Srimati Radharani, right? I mean, she controls God. That's one of the transcendental qualities of Srimati Radharani. Anyway, so Krishna wanted to understand her great love, by which she controls him. And so, of course, we know one thing is that Krishna appeared as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But in this particular story by Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur, Krishna, in order to understand Radharani's love, he dressed in drag. In other words, he dressed up as a demigoddess. So anyway, so here's a story, a very interesting story by Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur, that Krishna came into Radharani's house dressed as a demigoddess. Because generally men can't enter Radharani's house because they keep guards there. And Radharani's friends also, you know, they won't let any guy come in. Even Krishna sometimes is restricted. So Krishna was there, he dressed up as a demigod, and this demigoddess was crying. Crying. And every time one of the ladies asked the demigoddess, who was actually Krishna, what's the problem? Then the demigoddess would cry more. You know, severe clinical depression. So, finally Radharani said, you know, you're so attractive, you're such a nice person, you know, because you have an aura, you're effulgent. So, you know, I accept you as one of my friends. So tell me, you know, why are you crying? And then this demigoddess, who is actually Krishna, says, I'm crying because I've seen the harsh treatment that Krishna was giving you. That Krishna was just like treating you so harshly that in the beginning of the Rasa dance, he left with you. He left all the other girls and he left with you. And then he just dumped you. You know the story? It's in the Bhagavatam. He just dumped you, and there you were crying and just bereft. And you know, how can you love that person? You know, this is ridiculous. How can you love that person? And then Krishna, of course, wanted to understand Radharani's love. And Radharani replied to Krishna. She said, actually, Krishna left me for my benefit. And it's interesting because there's one explanation given by the Acharyas in the Bhagavatam, and there's another interesting explanation given by Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur too, in this particular story. I mean, in the Bhagavatam we generally hear that Radharani became too proud, right? Because, you know, Krishna left with her and left all the other girls behind. But there's really an esoteric point to this too. That, of course, Radharani, she never becomes overwhelmed by this opulence that she has. There's no question of her becoming too proud in the materialistic sense. I mean, if she exhibits pride, that's her mana, that's to give Krishna pleasure. So, Radharani actually explains why Krishna left her alone, which is quite an interesting explanation. She says that, Krishna, you know, walked off with me, but I was thinking, and this also exhibits the compassion of a pure devotee. The pure devotee doesn't become proud. And of course, Radharani is the best of the pure devotees. She said, Krishna walked off with me, but what was I thinking of? I was thinking of my poor girlfriends who were left alone. Interesting, isn't it? Like, most of you ladies, if some, you know, super handsome man walked off with you and left everybody else in the temple alone, you'd be thinking, that's their tough luck. So, you know, because people basically don't want to share. Especially, you know, this, and the love in this world is like a possessive type of thing. That you don't, anyway, you don't like to, I mean, just like we know about polygamy, although many people extol the glories of polygamy, it usually ends up, you know, like the word in Sanskrit, sapatni, sapatnya, means with one's enemies. And you hear so many stories about this in the Bhagavatam. People think, oh, it's so romantic, you know. And even in the news, you find these Mormon families being portrayed as like very happy, you know, 10 wives, one husband. But what goes on behind the scenes, you know, shoo-wee. I don't want to think about it. So, because love in this world is a very possessive thing. You know, if your husband looks at a magazine with a picture of a girl and says, isn't she good looking? And steam comes out of your ears. or if the wife is looking at some man, you know, just, wow, he's so handsome. You know? And then the man just like feels like complete, you know, anyway, there's envy in this world. So, but Radharani was not proud like that. She was thinking of her friends. She was thinking, my friends, I want them to be with me. I want them to be with me. And they were looking for her too. So what happened is that Krishna understood, and Radharani understood Krishna's mind. Krishna understood that if her friends caught up with her, and Krishna was there too, they would criticize her for, you know, running away with Krishna. So it really wouldn't work out. There would be a bad mood that would enter into the rasa dance. Krishna wanted the rasa dance, and he wanted to keep Radharani in the center. Now, the other girls might get a little upset with this. So therefore, Krishna had to arrange things so that they weren't envious of her. And so what happened is Krishna left her, and then she was left alone crying. And then what happened is that the other girls caught up with her, and they found her crying, and they felt so sorry for her, seeing her intense love, because love is exhibited to the highest degree in separation. In meeting, I mean, it can be all right. In meeting, you know, when two people are meeting, it's just like, you know, Hare Krishna. But it's... You know, anyway, I don't need to get into the details. You know, boy and girl mean, oh, I love you, love you, love you, love you. But in separation, more intense emotions are exhibited. And, I mean, how many girls or boys are just like faint, fall to the ground, drown, you know, tears coming from the eyes like torrents of rain, heart stops beating, practically speaking. Breathing becomes so shallow you can hardly detect it. Like what you're telling you. I mean, you don't see that in ordinary love in this world. You know, someone may say, I forget that person. I want to forget that person. That's, you know, that's the separation in this world. Or like, I don't know if you remember this musical from the 1960s. I want to wash that man out of my hair. So Rodgers and Hammerstein. I'm not going to sing the song. So, but Radharani, I mean, the gopis saw Radharani just like completely, almost dead, feeling separation. Therefore, they understood her exalted position. So that's really why Krishna left Radharani. And then Krishna, getting back to the story, oh, I have time to finish. It's such an interesting story. Then Krishna, in the form of the demigoddess, he said, well, if you knew that, then why did you start crying like that? You know, if you knew it was just Krishna's doing that, you know, for the sake. And then Radharani reveals that, that I'm simply doing this, for, you know, I'm feeling separation because this is my relationship with Krishna, and also, but I understood at the same time why Krishna was doing that. Even if you understand why someone is doing that, you can still feel intense emotions. And then Krishna questioned Radharani. You know, Krishna is a demigoddess. He questioned Radharani. He said, what do you mean you knew why Krishna did it? You know, I think you're just speculating. And she said, look, there's never any separation between me and Krishna. We are like two flames in the same wick. I mean, it's an interesting explanation of Radha and Krishna's relationship, how deep and close that relationship is. We're two like two flames in the same wick. And she gave other examples in that particular regard, how close she and Krishna were. And then Krishna challenged her. Krishna, as a demigoddess challenger, said, look, if you're actually that close to Krishna, and Krishna was there, then if you simply think of him and ask him to come, will he come? I challenge you. And she just became very upset hearing this, but she didn't know it was Krishna. And then ultimately, she said, yes, he will come if I just meditate on him. And I just pray for him to come. So she closed her eyes and meditated on Krishna. Krishna, please come. Please come right away. And then, of course, Krishna was already there, as we know. And so Krishna, what Krishna did is he changed his garb immediately. And he immediately started, you know, kissing Radharani. And she was amazed. And she opened her eyes and there was Krishna. And she said, how did you get here? And Krishna said, by your meditation and deep love, you brought me here. And then she looked around and said, you know, where did the demigoddess go? And the other girls said, because they had seen the whole thing, they had seen was Krishna. They said that Krishna, the demigoddess, has actually gone to another room in your house. So we'll go and look for her and leave you alone, because we're going to find her. So all the other gopis left, and there was Radha and Krishna together. So there's a happy ending of the story. So the point I'm making in this story is that Srimati Radharani, in spite of having all opulences, much more than anybody can conceive of, because she controls God, is not in the least proud. And she's always thinking of Krishna's pleasure, and she's always thinking of her associate's pleasure. I mean, she's completely compassionate. It's amazing. She's not thinking, you know, I own Krishna, you know, I'm the best, I'm better than all of you. She's simply thinking, and trying to bring, from time to time, she tries to bring her associates to associate with Krishna, to have a relationship with Krishna. And her associates are not interested in that. They're interested in having her. So there's so much love, not only for Krishna, but there's love for each other in the spiritual world. It's interesting, isn't it? So her associates are always trying to have her associate with Krishna, making arrangements. And she's trying to make arrangements many times for her associates to have a relationship with Krishna. Interesting. So this is pridelessness. So here, in this particular verse, getting back to Vaidhi Bhakti, is Bali Maharaj does not become attached or does not become bewildered by his opulence. And the reason it's called spiritual opulence is because he's using his opulence in Krishna's service. Material opulence, it may appear exactly the same. You know, one may be intelligent, one may have money, whatever. Dhanam, janam, sundari, followers, whatever. But one, in one case, they're using it for their own aggrandizement. In another case, someone is using it to please Krishna. And Prabhupada says in a previous purport, going back a little ways, that one should be careful not to misuse one farthing. That people are giving, like, type of opulence, people are giving money to the Krishna conscious movement. And so as soon as you misuse it, it becomes material. And when you use it properly in Krishna's service, then it's spiritual. So how to maintain that attitude? We can learn from Srimati Radharani how to maintain that attitude. And she is simply thinking of giving Krishna pleasure and giving pleasure to the other devotees of the Lord. So if we maintain that consciousness, that attitude, that sense of identity that we are servants of a servant of the Lord, not simply servants of the Lord, but servants of a servant of a servant, Lobivarta Padakamalu Dasa Dasa Hasanu Dasa, then we could always utilize things properly in Krishna service and not become proud of whatever opulence is that we have. But it's very dangerous. Whenever we have an opulence, we have to be very careful about it. You know, money especially, or followers. I mean, we've seen so many people succumb to the allurement of misusing or using the opulence in their own service rather than Krishna's service. So one has to be very, very careful with these things. So, any questions or comments? I finished it. Yeah.
We've seen, but during, in the process, the person may be thinking, I'm a devotee, I have to maintain myself. So many excuses, peripheral thinking. And so, what is the practical application of discrimination in order to deal with opulence or financial capacity?
Well, like you said, use the word discrimination. One has to understand that how to carry out one's particular service to Krishna to maximize one's service to Krishna. That's the real point. Not that we give up opulences in the name of becoming renounced from this material world, thinking, you know, I could just sleep on the floor. I mean, for example, I'll give my own example. About a few months ago, I don't remember how many months ago, I thought, you know, a sannyasi, I should sleep on the floor. Why am I sleeping on a bed? So, therefore, I think I threw my futon out or something like that. I took my futon and chucked it out the door. Said, this is nonsense. And then so, you know, renunciation, not accepting any more than required. And so then I started sleeping on the floor, but then I didn't sleep so well at night. And then during the day I was kind of groggy, snappy. You know, because when you're overtired, you know, someone will ask you a question and you just tell the person to go to hell. So, not so good for preaching Krishna consciousness. So therefore, I understood that, you know, it's necessary to have a little bit more material opulence, so to maximize my service rather than destroy my service to Krishna. So for each person, that question has to be answered, by utilizing their intelligence and conscience. Not to accept more. I mean, if you accept more, then it actually increases one's false prestige. I mean, just like I experienced with eating. You know, so we talk about achahara prayasa chapachapati magra. Overeating, overcollecting is actually detrimental or causes the destruction of one's devotional service. Then I experience, like, if I eat too much, even a little too much, then, first of all, you need to sleep more. But secondly, you become more passionate, not in a romantic sense, not my age, but you become more passionate in the sense that you get angry easier, or become more, you can't sit still and just read. Isn't that? I mean, many people have experienced, told me about this, you know, when they eat too many chickpeas, yeah. You know, chickpeas especially are one of the most dangerous things. Isn't that used to be chickpeas?
No, but I know people that would eat them at night.
And they just got, the next day, they're just dangerous to deal with. The people, not the chickpeas. They're like little bombs. You throw them, boom. Like that. So you really have to control. I mean, if you eat too little, you'll be too weak to serve Krishna. In the name of renunciation, you'll be too weak. You'll be gone. So we have to understand to maximize, the standard I have is to maximize the service. Not simply to minimize your bodily needs. I mean, that's one point. But I think more important is maximize the service you do for Krishna, which is helping people come to Krishna consciousness, distributing prasadam, serving the deities, chanting the holy names. I mean, these are all service things. So it's like a bell curve. At a certain point, you accept more, you do more, you accept more, you do more, you accept more, you do more, and then after a point, it falls off. You accept more, you do less. You understand what I mean? Like a bell curve. Eat more, wow, serving Krishna, more, 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 serving Krishna, more, blah. Now, I'm just angry at everybody. Then he becomes so passionate, especially with chickpeas, isn't it? He eats chickpeas and he becomes so passionate you're ready to take on the whole world, go to the football, you know, instead of going to the Sunday feast, going to the football games on Sunday. Anyway, on that happy note, I'm not saying that chickpeas are not prohibited for devotees. But really, anyway, you'll have to figure that out for yourself. What maximizes your service to the Vaishnavas and Krishna?